Well, thanks for asking me to come here. It sounds like this has been a very interesting month. I'm sort of keen to hear more about what the sort of frontier of star formation is in terms of the modeling prospects. I'm sort of here to address the observational side from a QA perspective. So before I talk about sort of an overall view, I just wanted to say that where I'm coming from is from a long-term project using the Spitzer Space Telescope called GLIMPSS, okay? And so this is sort of GLIMPSS really was a set of different projects that we all together in the end have just glued together. So there was originally GLIMPSS, which was just the inner galaxy, plus or minus 1 degree in latitude and plus or minus 65 degrees in longitude. GLIMPSS 2 filled in the inner galaxy. By the way, I won't mention who, but one of the lead people in the Spitzer project said before the mission started, said, over my dead body will they point this telescope at galactic center, because the galactic center is incredibly bright and Spitzer is amazingly sensitive. And I don't think they anticipated that we would turn Spitzer into a survey telescope. But because it's so sensitive, you can cover a large fraction of the galactic plane very quickly. There was the galactic center thing, so it actually, that was not us, but we reprocessed the data. GLIMPSS 3D added some vertical tabs. I was a PI on that project. Vela Carina covered another part of the disk. There was these smaller projects. And then once we ran out of coolant in Spitzer and two of the four IRAC channels stopped working, we were only left with the 3.6 and 4.5 micron channels. And those were, and then we got two fairly large projects to do just those two bands, but deeper. So this is the people in Wisconsin that managed to survive the whole 10 years. Of course, it relies on the Spitzer. So for the very first time since 2003, we're actually done taking data. It's been this long slog of, the data just keeps coming and coming and coming, and we're a smaller and smaller group as time went on, but we're done. One of the reasons that this is, I think, will end up being a very useful and important project is because, of course, it's in the mid-infrared where the galaxy is almost transparent. So we can actually see edge-on galaxies across the entire disk. We can actually see an edge-on galaxy less than 2 degrees from galactic center. Okay, so we're seeing through the entire Milky Way. But the second thing is, I mean, the galaxy, the disk is thin, okay? And sort of, if you imagined a little experiment here where you like take the galaxy and you slice it in half, and pretend that distant half is another galaxy, that other half of the Milky Way galaxy fits into just a little over plus or minus 1 degree in latitude, right? So if you don't survey that plus or minus 1 degree strip, you're missing about half of the galactic disk, okay? So as it turns out, even though we were a narrow strip and the little movie I was showing before showed the whole survey, it turns out this survey contains approximately 64% of all the stars, 90% of all the star formation. It's produced 653 refereed publications. That's 12% of all of the publications from the Spitzer Space Telescope. It covered about 1,200 square degrees, 4,300 hours, 229 million point sources, and a lot of fun. And I have to show the one brag plot. This is actually showing the cumulative number of refereed papers coming out of some of the different Spitzer legacy programs. And so here's MIPSGAL and SWIRE and GOODS. SINGS, C2D, and then there's GLIMPSS. So we're up to 650 papers. So it's been a useful project partly because we just covered a ton of area, right? I mean, so the data tends to be useful to lots and lots of people. I wanted to talk a little bit about, the structure of the Milky Way and the context of star formation. So have a similar modus operandi here. I wanted to start off with an analogy, okay? And that is an analogy to mapping. This is actually a map of Africa. It was called Abyssinia, or the Empire of Prester John, which is an amazingly ethnocentric title. But it's by Gerhard Mercator, of the Mercator projection. And when you look at this map, a couple things you notice. First of all, the longitude grid is not what we use nowadays. Okay, Mercator always liked to put the longitude zero in the Atlantic to separate the old world and the new world. Another thing you notice is that the width is 50 degrees from the equator from the tip to the coast. And And so you would think over time the maps would improve. Here's a map of Africa in 1805. It was by the authorities, and you know that because it says a new map of Africa from the latest authorities, okay? and so it actually shows a map of Africa, and look how much worse this map looks in certain respects. Okay, I'll zoom in. The coastline is almost approaching the modern precision, okay? But the problem was the interior of Africa. Suddenly you have giant things like labeled unknown, and the width is about right now. It's almost exactly right. But you have things called unknown parts. In other words, we unlearned the interior of Africa by 1805. And they didn't know what to do. And the fundamental problem they had in mapping is, how do you merge the high precision, reliable stuff with the less precise interior stuff that was actually based on traveler reports as recorded by Ptolemy in 150 AD. And this is the problem that we're going to face in galactic astronomy in the next several years. And the reason is because we have a lot of sort of ideas about the Milky Way structure based on 60 years of work. And we're suddenly getting hit now by parallax measurements. And parallaxes are the gold standard in mapping, right? But how do we merge the parallax data, which we trust, I mean, I think we get, occasionally parallaxes are wrong, but you always know why, with all of the other attempts to map the galaxy in the past. If you just say, we're only going to start all over and only use what Gaia gives us, you're going to throw out most of the entire disk. And so you're going to have to label the central part of the disk of the Milky Way will suddenly become unknown parts, unless we find a way to merge this data. The analogy I wanted to make then is that basically this map of Africa in 1620, I would say, is sort of analogous to this artist picture that I was bear some responsibility for. If you've seen this, and this is actually something we did as it was intended for the general public. It's now been published in APJ, not by me. But it was our best attempt to try to merge together all of these historical accounts practically. So I think this, if this is sort of analogous to this, then this 1805 map is where we're heading, okay? In other words, we're gonna have parallaxes from Gaia, we're gonna have parallaxes from BLBA of some objects in the disk. We can map the red clump stars, I'll get to that in a minute, fairly precisely, but then the rest of it, what do we do? Okay, so I just wanted to point out that you can expect the fights in galactic structure to get, I mean, the maps of the galaxy will probably look worse in the future than they do
now. Also, what you mentioned to me the other day is that you actually won't see in the disk because you can't see through the disk.
Yes, I was going to point that out. Yeah, the Gaia cannot see, you know, Gaia is going to be fantastic. I mean, it's going to revolutionize our knowledge of the halo and the thick disk and the nearby solar neighborhood. But anything that you can, anything behind dust, Gaia can't see. And most of the galaxy is behind dust, right? So be aware. I think the Gaia people don't tend to highlight that, but it's, and actually the Japanese are actually thinking about trying to do a mission that's sort of like Gaia, but in the near infrared, which would push us a lot deeper. So I think that's a really important idea, a really important effort. And I hope it actually happens. So I'm gonna talk about basically two regimes of star formation related to this. First of all, I'm going to give you just a little bit of mapping preliminaries because anytime we're talking about the structure and the overall pattern of star formation in the Milky Way, the global picture, we have to talk about how we assemble that. And then I'm going to hit two different areas. One is the outer disk, which is sort of relevant to our discussion today. And then the second is I'm going to focus on one arm or one structure, which is the dominant star-forming structure of the Milky Way. Okay. But the thing to remember about the Milky Way is that in both of these cases and everywhere else in the Milky Way, the beauty of the Milky Way is we can resolve the three-dimensional structure, right? There's no other galaxy where you can really look in detail at the vertical distribution of everything, okay? In a distance resolves kind of way. So the Milky Way is always going to be unique and always going to be a useful test of any type of theory of galaxies, evolution and star formation. So just as a reminder, how do you map things? If you have stars, you would get parallaxes for all of them. There was Hipparchos in the very local solar neighborhood, but then Gaia will get the nearby disk and it'll get higher latitudes, but it's going to miss a lot of the right in the disk. Or you do standard candles, where you minimize or correct for extinction and find a standard candle with the narrow luminosity function. I'm going to do that in a second. How do you map gas? Well, if you're lucky and you have masers, you can get the parallaxes of the masers and associate them with the gas clouds. Okay, and that's been done for about 105 parallax. There's 105 published parallaxes now between the Japanese VIRA group and the US and European VLBA consortium called BESSEL. But most of the mapping of the gas in the Milky Way is done kinematically. You measure emission absorption line profiles, you use the model of galactic rotation, you hope that it's circular, but it's actually not, and you can demonstrate that in many different areas. Inside the solar circle, you need to resolve the kinematic distance ambiguity. This used to be a big problem, it's not so much anymore. Routinely, people are resolving this ambiguity for hundreds to thousands of objects. Or you can basically measure the extinction versus distance and use a model of stellar density. By the way, this was the way they used to map the galaxy in 1930s, okay? And we're actually getting back to that now because of these giant stellar surveys that we have now. And then finally, how do you map the star formation? Again, parallaxes of the masers, kinematic distances to the H2 regions, or standard candles, that is OB stars. And one of the great things about the history of the field is that these were the two things that were originally done to map the spiral structure, and they didn't agree in terms of their maps. By the way, I am writing a review on the spiral structure of the Milky Way. It's called Evidence for Spiral Structure of the Milky Way, because I think people fight about whether they're, you know, all the different, how do you put together all this evidence into a coherent pattern? There's a lot of fighting about the patterns, about the models, the assembly of a global picture. I think there's really less fighting about the actual data. There's plenty of evidence. It's just how you assemble it where the fights break out. So star counts. We're going to start off with mapping the stars and the three-dimensional distribution of stars, and we're going to head towards the outer disk. So this shows an optical picture of a section of the galactic plane, 28.5, and right in the midplane, 0.5. And this is about an hour exposure done with a Wind 0.9 meter telescope with a student. And then if you take the same section of the sky and you go to the near infrared, okay, you can see more stars. And I'm going to run this backwards in a second. And then if you go to the mid-IR, this is this view in mid-IR. Okay? So now, what I'd like you to do is pick a bright star. Okay? And now, most of the bright stars you're going to pick are going to be basically M-giants. In the plane, or red supergiants, or most. Actually, it turned out this area, which was considered typical field for a very long Chandra-pointed observation, is anything but typical. It has one of the largest concentrations of red supergiants in the entire Milky Way, but they didn't know that when they picked it. But now pick a bright star and let's go backwards. And your bright star is probably gone, right? And those bright stars are the ones that Gaia is not going to see. Okay, so all of those things, which are, you know, these giant beacons, many of them seen across the galaxy, there's not going to be parallaxes for those because they're behind dust. Okay, so we're functioning without Gaia. So one of the things you can do with data like this is you can go back to what they used to do, Kapteyn's great experiment in 1920, and William Herschel and Carolyn Herschel, 1765. You make star counts, and this shows a star count map right of the inner galaxy in J. Look at all that extinction, right? All those dust lanes and things. H, K, 3.6, 4.5, and 5.8. So this is just to hammer home, if you didn't believe it already, that extinction really makes a difference. That looking in the galaxy in the J band is not the same as looking in 5.8, okay? So how do you convert that into information on structure? Now, rather than focus on the inner part of the galaxy, I'm gonna actually focus on the outer disk, okay? So when you do take the outer disk, if you just look at a section of the sky, okay, and pick a section of the sky, pick a bunch of stars, make a histogram, so you then convert each pixel that you've divided in the sky into the number of stars versus the magnitude, where I always part. There's a bit of a thing here. I always put bright on the right and faint on the left. And what you get here are these histograms right here, okay? So these are just different directions along the galactic plane, different longitudes. And it turns out in the outer galaxy, here's one of the things you see. You see a flattening in the histograms, okay? And that flattening, if you pick a histogram, and so that I've highlighted these flattenings, they're a little bit subtle, but I've brought them out here by color coding the slopes of the histograms, so that basically when it goes blue, that means it's a flattening. So basically, flatter is bluer and steeper is redder. And so you've got a flattening here and a flattening here and a flattening here and so on and so forth. And actually, those flattenings are in every direction we look in the outer galaxy. So what is that? Why do the histograms have a flattening? Yeah?
That's not strictly a local thing, because where you have something with colored red there, that also seems flatter. So is that in some...
I guess like here, you're saying, or?
Or
I mean, I've boxcar smoothed this to bring it out. So I boxcar smoothed about by about half a magnitude here. These things when seen on a single histogram are not terribly convincing, but when you sort of do all of them together, as you'll see, the pattern really stands out. Does that answer your question? Okay. So let's go on, and so let's look at those flattenings. What I'm going to do now is I'm going to display those histograms in a weird way. And I find this, people have a hard time getting this, but I think what I do is I say, here's the histogram, and each histogram gets slotted into a vertical segment. And so what I show here is longitude, and then magnitude, and then that color of the slope is just indicated in this two-dimensional space. Okay? And so, for instance, one of the histograms I showed you was at this longitude, about 150. And you'll notice that if at bright magnitudes, you know, it's sort of a mess because it's noisy because there's not a lot of stars. But by the time you get down to 12th magnitude, there's that flattening in the histogram, okay? And then you see it actually gets steeper here, and then it gets a little less steep here. And so there's been some smoothing here, and some part of the secret is in the smoothing. But basically what you see is that this flattening corresponds to this little blue section in the diagram, right? Does everyone get that, by the way? Slopes of histograms, plot the slopes in a two-dimensional space, longitude versus magnitude. And so it's a way of displaying histograms. By the way, notice that I haven't done anything. I'm just displaying the data. It's a weird way of displaying the data, but it's just, I'm not color selecting, I'm not extinction correcting, I'm just displaying data. And so I want to do this because I think it's important to always sort of see the evidence for what I'm about to show. So there's the thing. And notice that this blue band, okay, actually changes apparent magnitude as a function of direction. And so it's closer to us, it's brighter at 180, and it gets fainter as you move away from the galactic anticenter. So what is it? Well, what it is a class of stars. Before I tell you that, let me just say that one of the things you can do then is you can actually take our data and you can do extinction corrections are not a big problem in the mid-infrared, as you can see from those images I show you. But you can do extinction corrections and try to figure out the estimated extinction star by star along your line of sight using a clever technique that Steve Majeski came up with. And so this shows a model of an inner field in the inner galaxy. And this shows, after you do the extinction correction, what you get for a typical field. And you'll notice when you look at the model, it's a little more clear in the model, so I'll stay over here. You sort of see, well, there's some stuff here. And do people sort of see that there's two bands in this model, right? There's sort of stars here, and then there's another band of stars here. And this is in J minus K. So basically, this is a near IR color magnitude diagram, right? Well, as it turns out, what you're seeing there are three, basically, classes of stars. It's hard to do color separation. I mean, this is the only sort of color separation you can do in the near IR, is you can separate this color space into dwarfs. So dwarf stars are pretty much near zero color. And then red giants are over here. So these are the red giants. And then that intermediate region is something called red clump giants, okay? Now, just out of curiosity, how many people know what red clump giants are? Raise your hand if you know what a red clump giant is. Two. Probably because you heard from me. Okay, so let me actually just remind you what a red clump giant is. Anyone know what's going to happen to the sun in the future? The sun, okay, I mean, we're among friends here, right? I used to be an ISM theory type, and I was like, I had to learn about red clump giants. I guess I didn't pay enough attention in my stellar evolution class. But the basic idea is, as the sun goes off the main sequence, by the way, is there a way to light? Yeah, so main sequence, log of luminosity, temperature. We have the main sequence. I think everyone remembers that. You may remember that the main sequence typically is divided into mass ranges, okay? If we pick a mass range, say from 0.5 solar masses, by the way, that wouldn't have evolved off the main sequence. Those stars actually haven't gone off the main sequence yet, because there hasn't been enough time in the age of the universe. But all the way up to 2 solar masses, stars in that range, including the sun, go off. They go up the red giant branch, okay? So this is the red giant branch. They reach the tip. That tip is thought to be relatively insensitive to things, so that the tip of the red giant branch is used as a distance indicator for other galaxies. And then when the helium core ignites, the degenerate helium core ignites, the stars come down, and then they live here for a long time. Okay, and this thing is called the red clump. Now, you may have, if you took a stellar evolution class, you were probably biased by the fact that we always learn stellar evolution in the context of globular clusters. And globular clusters are low metallicity stars. If you go to solar metallicity stars, what globular cluster people call the horizontal branch compresses into a clump. And so, you know, a low metallicity set of stars would be like this, but solar metallicity, it all lives there. So it's basically the helium burning sequence of a star's lifetime. So you can imagine that A, because it depends only on the helium core mass, it's actually a nice standard candle because it doesn't depend on the previous mass laws, okay? And in fact, there's enough of them in the solar neighborhood that it's estimated that the magnitude uncertainty, that is the luminosity histogram, is about 0.03 mags. In other words, it's an incredibly tight peak in the solar neighborhood based on 200 sources. So in reality, it's probably worse than that, and there is some population effects and so on. That gives you a distance mapping, a distance resolution of about 1%, by the way. If you really believe this, you have 1% accuracy distances. So anyway, so these things they come from low mass stars, they're bright, they're standard candles, they're perfect. And you can see that they actually dominate in a sample of red giants. I mean, they're about 50% of the red giants in a given direction. And red giants are bright, and that's what we see. So everyone with me so far? Okay. So that's the evidence. So now let's go ahead and we're going to take those same diagrams I showed you, showing the slopes of histogram, and we're going to correct them for extinction. And so this shows that diagram I showed you before, and this shows you the J band, the slopes of the J band. But this is actually the J band before I do the extinction correction. Okay. Now, if you do this extinction correction where you're assuming that there's a standard color for stars, an H minus 4.5 of fixed value. By the way, in case you care, the reason this works is because both the H band and the 4.5 micron band have a CO feature in them. And so it turns out those things scale, and it's independent of whether the star is a giant or a dwarf. So you end up with a nice standard candle. So this is before extinction correction. This is after. So there's the blue band in J. Then in H, then in K, then in 3.6, and then in 4.5. So what I wanted you to see here is that once we do the extinction correction, the blue band always basically lies in exactly the same place. And it's following a galactocentric, I haven't said what these white lines are. Because this band is produced by red clumps, and because red clumps have a known absolute magnitude, we can convert apparent magnitude to distance, apparent and absolute magnitude to distance. And so we can actually put in a distance scale onto this plot. And so this blue band is basically at approximately a constant galactocentric distance of about 14 kiloparsecs. And this is what we call, what people have called in the past, the truncation of the Milky Way, which is a dangerous term and has caused a lot of confusion. A better way to name this thing is it's called the break, the stellar break. And just so people know where I'm going, the reason this break is important in star formation is because imagine you have, it's a perfect experiment for understanding the physics of star formation. Imagine you have a disk and suddenly the stars went away, but the H1 goes smoothly through that break. So you've suddenly changed the surface gravity of the galaxy without changing anything else. So it's a great place to do experiments on star formation. And I'll show you some interesting things about that in a second. So that's the break. This is basically me fitting those flattenings. This is what you get before extinction. And after you correct for extinction, this is what you get. All of the bands now lie on top of each other, except for the J band. But remember, red clump giants have a J minus K color. And so even if I didn't know what red clump giants were, I could have told you that the sources producing the flattening in the histogram have a J minus K color of 0.5.
Why don't you see them all along?
What?
So you're saying there's a feature at a particular distance, but since the number density is higher, closer, why aren't you seeing them at all other intermediate distances?
Oh, you are. Yeah, I mean, so essentially you're seeing them at all distances, but what I'm seeing is that, you know, if here you are, right, and you're looking in a direction, you're getting red clumps and red clumps all along the way in your line of sight. But then what happens is, at a certain point, the density will suddenly go down, okay? So when I make my histograms, I have everything, right? But in reality, my histogram consists of a mixture of, there's the red giants, which basically look like this, and then the red clumps, and then the dwarf stars, and then you merge these into one histogram.
I guess naively you think it would get steeper because you run out of things.
The slope of it?
If you run out of things, then you might think the slope would get steeper. But
well, I mean, what it's trying to do is it's trying to turn over, right? And actually, I have, by the way, I'm not going to show it because I'm still working on it, but I have actually made a pure selection of just red clump giants. I mean, the reason I always start this way is because I want to convince people that you can just see it in the raw data. You know, it's just, I mean, didn't have to do anything to find this other than plot the data, okay? But knowing what I know now, I can actually go through, color select just the red clumps, and their histograms do, in fact, just look like this. They turn over. And then I can convert that to a density map with the standard problems is that was I complete in terms of getting all the red clump giants, what's the level of contamination I have? And those are tricky questions to answer, so that's why I'm partly staying away from it. But at any rate, the point is that there's the thing, and the reason you're getting these red clump giants, the reason you're getting the flattening in the raw histograms is because you have a certain number of stars, and this histogram, basically you have giant stars, and at a certain radius, the number of giants go away, right? But then you still have the dwarf stars in the raw histograms. And so if the red giants go away quickly, that is a hard truncation with a scale length of basically the outer scale length is zero, then you get a very deep dive. If the truncation or the break is more gentle, where you're switching to a different scale length, then it becomes flatter. And so with a small mismatch, I mean, if there's only a small mismatch in the exponential scaling for the inner disk and this beyond the breakpoint, you wouldn't see a flattening of the histogram. Okay, so you see enough of a flattening to know that there is a drop off in the density at a certain radius. Okay, now any questions up to that point? So just to give you a sense of how this diagram works, I'm not going to say a lot about this, but basically I just viewed what would a pure exponential disk look like if you put in a luminosity function, you put in a density function, and then you just plotted the slopes of histograms, right? And so this is actually what an exponential disk would look like in this weird way of displaying stellar data. And really, slopes of histograms are basically telling you about the density of stars along your line of sight. By the way, this was in the original Mihalis Galactic Astronomy. It was in the second edition of Galactic Astronomy by Mihalis and Binney. It dropped out of the most recent edition of Galactic Astronomy. They actually took it out because who does star counts anymore? Just at the time where it was going to be useful for me. So it turns out that so basically here in the inner galaxy, you're going up a density gradient. The density is going up, so the slopes are going up. And then beyond the tangent point, basically the slopes are going down. Okay, and then this stuff here has to do with dwarf stars over here. But anyway, so that's an exponential disk. There's what happens when you put a hole in. There's what happens when you put a warp in. By the way, I said that the feature I see is a break. But that's you will get fights on that because in a single direction, all I can tell you is that the density of stars has dropped, right? The density of stars has dropped beyond just sort of a simple exponential. But that could be because the galaxy stopped, or it could be because the galaxy curved up and your line of sight left the galaxy. And in a single direction, you can't tell the difference between those two ideas. Okay? So, and then here's what happens if you put in a truncation and then a bar. So this is the sort of just basically pre-existing density model, standard luminosity function. Here's the sort of theory. There is the data. Okay, so it's not, there's some similarities. So let's move on. As it turns out, by the way, notice that I could see that flattening of slopes in two mass. Okay, two mass is all sky. And so that means you can actually map out the place where the stellar density drops three-dimensionally. In every place in the sky, you can actually map where the stellar density drops. So you can actually construct a three-dimensional map of this break. Here actually shows a slice of at latitude of plus 6.5. You'll notice this blue band cuts through the white lines. That means that the break position is actually getting closer to the center of the galaxy over here and further away from the center of the galaxy over here. Down here on the bottom, it's the opposite, okay? So at any rate, so one has to be careful because it turns out that when in any given direction, you could be looking out of the galaxy through the warp, you could be seeing a break, or you could be looking through an additional structure, right? There could be another, like a satellite. You hit a density rise and density fall. And actually, all three of those things, it turns out, are probably happening. So let me actually show you now a three-dimensional slice. I'm going to slice the galaxy like a pie and show you where is that break projected into galactocentric radius and vertical height. So this is actually a physical map, but what I'm showing you is where do we get those flattenings. And so when you see coherent patterns that all sort of line up, so this is showing the angle. So when you see black bands that start to coalesce, what you're seeing is the boundary of the break, okay? And so this is the midplane right here. And you'll notice, see that right there? So you're seeing actually the break of the galaxy sort of going below the midplane. And then as we go, by the way, this is not, I limited it to just plus or minus 15 degrees latitude, so I've already fixed that. I just haven't remade the movie. But now, as we go to the other side of galactic center, or the anti-center, you'll notice that now the galaxy is warping up, and you're seeing the boundary of the stellar disk out at about 14 kiloparsecs. So this is, again, the message I want to drive home to you, is that the galaxy provides a perfect opportunity for star formation experiments because the galaxy has decided to shut off its stellar density at a certain radius. And that radius is not the radius you might have known, because like Mark, I noticed you said the galaxy goes out to 22 kiloparsecs. The stellar density takes a big dive before 20 kiloparsecs. It takes it at 13, okay?
So from the dwarfs, though, the dwarfs, as you said, keep going.
Well, but the dwarfs are all much closer, right? They're dwarf stars, and so they're fainter. So you're mixing a population. These are all nearby, these are actually the furthest. You actually, in the mid-infrared, when you have no extinction, you get this inversion where the brightest sources are actually the most distant ones. And then the next brightest class of sources are actually at intermediate distance. And then the faintest class of sources is actually the closest because of the luminosity function, right? Giants, although they are more rare than dwarfs, tend to be much more luminous to compensate since they have a larger volume. So you get this weird inversion. So now let me show you. I'll just show you one slice of that movie. This shows one slice of galactocentric 192. And you can see here is the boundary of the disk, okay, in stars. And in the same slice, here's what the H1 surface density is doing, okay? So I inset this, but I sort of set the edge of the disk here at 15 kiloparsecs or so. So 15 kiloparsecs in this plot would be right here. For this particular slice, it almost looks like the H1 is sort of flattish or maybe even climbing a little bit, and then at 15 it starts to go down. I don't know if this is uniformly true for every slice through the galaxy, whether the H1 will end up sort of changing slope at the same place where the break happens. But I can show you that many other interesting things happen at the location of this break in the Milky Way. Okay, and so that's what I wanted to go through next. But before I do, one more movie. Now I'm going to slice the galaxy in a way that you would generally not slice a pie, okay? Most people do not slice a pie like the top layer and then the middle layer and then the bottom layer. If you do, you're sort of, I guess it'd be like the crust, right? You know, you can slice the top layer off. So I'm going to slice the layer like the galaxy like a pineapple, right? So there's these vertical slices. So this the slice here shows where we are. And basically, once again, when you see the band become coherent, you're seeing a coherent sort of place where the density of the galaxy is changing. So I'm finding a large density gradient. Okay. So there's some junk in here I haven't cleaned out, but notice you've got a band there, and then we have something here, and we have something here, okay? There's actually some confusion in the literature. These have been interpreted as dwarf galaxies. There's a couple things going on, and I'm picking up all of them with this technique. So I haven't sorted it out, and I wanted to make sure I at least had my ducks in a row before I entered this. So, but yeah, some people have claimed that the structures I'm seeing, which might be interpreted as the density boundary of the disk, are dwarf galaxies. So we'll have to sort that out. But in case you didn't know that the Milky Way had a break, here's a list of papers that should have told you that, okay? So the break was first claimed in 1992 based on dwarf stars, but just on four fields, so you would be forgiven if you didn't believe it, okay? Four directions and that's it. But it turns out the data holds up. Then red giants, then infrared light, but with a parameterized model of the galaxy, then a star count model, and then interestingly enough, A stars. Now A stars are interesting because those are not red giants. Those are not old stars. By the way, it takes half a giga-year to create a red clump. So we're not talking about recent star formation. We're talking about old stuff. And then there's the red giant branch, possibly, in the inner galaxy. By the way, these authors were not brave enough to say they were seeing the edge of the galaxy, but it turns out it's suspiciously similar that the red giants suddenly drop off at a distance this far away. So they may have actually mapped out the boundary of the disk on the far side of the galaxy, including all the way through galactic center, which I think is quite remarkable if it holds up. And then what I'm saying here. So what else do we know about the breaks? Well, before I talk about the breaks, I do want to mention that if you think that the scale length, the exponential scale length of the stellar disk of the Milky Way is known, you are wrong. In the literature, what I find is that every person believes the number they measured. So they measure the scale length of the disk, and I've seen good people do this. They measure their scale length, and of course they're right, and those other people had something wrong with their data or their analysis. And so I will believe that we have a final value for the scale length of the exponential disk of the Milky Way when someone proves not just that how they got their number, but why other people got the numbers they did, okay? Because you know, these people, all these people are not idiots, right? I mean, they were taking their data, they were sampling it in easy to understand ways. The, much of the data is publicly available now. So we can resolve this problem if we can just be smart about it, okay? I think. Or maybe we...
So what do you think was, your number is bigger.
My number is bigger. This comes down actually, I'll tell you what, actually I think I've made some progress on this. It turns out with my data set, depending on how I study it, I can actually get different scale lengths. Part of it is I get a different scale length in the inner galaxy than if I use the outer galaxy. Part of it is that if you don't know about the break, and then you get the wrong scale length. Because if you don't put the break in, I mean, for a single direction, there's no way to distinguish between the scale length and the break, right? You know, if you put in a break, you would, and if there were a break and you didn't know about, you would get too short a scale length. And so I think I'm seeing some hints of why people get what they do. But I don't know, you know, in some ways, I think the Milky Way is the perfect example to test whether, in fact, galactic stellar disks are, in fact, exponential, right? I mean, we just assume that in other galaxies, or I mean, it fits pretty well, but is the stellar density profile, is the stellar disk perfectly exponential? Or is it?
No.
What?
No, they're not axisymmetric and, you know, they're working.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's all sorts of issues. And
I mean, in terms of quantifying this number, I understand a lot of you are qualified, and lots of people have. But really, it's, you know, like just a stellar surface density profile, like that, you know.
And they fit it.
It doesn't seem like it's easier in the Milky Way than elsewhere. I think that would be hard to argue.
It's easier in the Milky Way because you can actually pull it apart by different populations.
But you can do like IFU imaging and measure like stellar velocity dispersions from absorption lines and actually have some like kinematically measured of what the, you know, for face on the spiral. What's actually going on in terms of the potential as a function of radius, and come up with I'm playing with exactly.
No, I mean, that's fair. I mean, but I mean, in the Milky Way, like, one of the things we know is the vertical scale height depends on the population, right? That's something you wouldn't know in any galaxy but the Milky Way, right? That the OB stars have a smaller scale height, vertical scale height than the, you know, than the K giants, for instance.
Well, I mean,
so maybe the same.
But in Andromeda, you get this from fat because you can look at different populations that are different characters. I mean, you
can actually see the difference in the vertical scale heights.
Yeah, and yeah. There, I mean, in some advanced galaxies, you can probably do this as well. So I've thought a lot over probably too long about different types of galaxies and, you know, exponential scale lengths, and you know, there is some value in saying that the galaxies form with an exponential scale, but you know, whether these numbers are different within statistical uncertainty.
Oh, I didn't put their error bars, but their error bars are all much tinier than the center values.
Okay. Let me just wrap up my ramble.
Okay.
That, you know, if there's a physically meaningful quantity, it's not, you know, it's okay to quantify things in terms of the scale, but whether things are perfectly exponential doesn't seem to matter.
Well, but you know, I think part of the thing is it's useful to try to test these ideas in the Milky Way because we can do, for instance, we have velocity discriminants, we can do stellar populations. So I mean, I think that, I mean, I would really like to see this problem solved, this issue solved. And so the bottom line, but it is complicated, and obviously so. I think if we understood why we're getting different numbers, we would have some more insight into what's going on in our own galaxy. Okay. I think that probably is a true statement. So.
Isn't there a contamination by bars and bars?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's another thing. Some of these older papers didn't know that the bar went out as far as it did, and so they went too far in, so they went in closer than 30 degrees from galactic center. Other directions, they didn't properly account for extinction. You know, there's a real mess of issues, and people have been trying this for a while. But I mean, I think that, you know, just like the break is sort of interesting because you can actually map the 3D structure of the stellar break in the Milky Way. I don't think you could do that anywhere else. But you can also map the 3D structure of the exponential disk and look at the vertical versus radial in different directions. So I mean, I just want to commend. So now let's talk about how this lies up with the other tracers. How many of you knew that the Milky Way was effectively truncated in molecular gas at 13.5 kiloparsecs? Good. You heard it from me. You knew it. How did you know?
Because I went to grad school at Berkeley and was required to read huge numbers of papers by people like Blitz.
Okay. Yeah, so I mean, the thing is, people do see molecular gas beyond 13.5. There's some examples, but it really does suddenly dive at 13.5. Is this a coincidence? You know, that suddenly when the stellar density goes down, the CO effectively disappears? And by the way, there's some these papers all talk about it, and I just wanted to point out that the break is not the same as the truncation. So a lot of reasons you might hear some people saying, I don't believe this, is because they say, oh, there's objects at 20 kiloparsec. Well, yes, you can have objects beyond the break, okay? So that's something to be aware of. Here also, by the way, is evidence. This is actually Evan Levine's Faison model of the H1 surface density of the galaxy based on the lab survey. And so you can see here's where the break is, and the break occurs at roughly 3 solar masses per square parsec in terms of where you suddenly see the drop-off in the stellar density, approximately. If you look at that other tracers of what the H1 does, you can see this shows the midpoint offset. Galaxy is very non-axis symmetrically warped, as many of you know, and then the half-thickness also changes. I do want to say, although I think this Levine paper is great, by projecting things into an XY plot, they actually obscure the fact what's actually more clear when you look at the raw data. So I just wanted to show you the raw data for a minute. I'm going to show you a movie. And the movie I'm going to show you is, initially, I'm going to show you CO. Okay. Now, this is a so-called longitude velocity plot. This is centered at 180. So we're looking in the outer galaxy. And I've put these color curves to lead your eye. This basically would be with a certain rotation model where I've actually used the Blitz and Levine model to include some non-circular rotation because the galaxy at L of 180 does not nail zero. So that is, we know there's something weird about the H1 kinematics. It's not perfectly circular. And so the curves here basically show distances of 10, 12, 14, 16 kiloparsecs. The black is the CO. Okay, this is from the Dame et al. Super survey. And what I'm going to show you is that you can see patterns in the CO, and I'm also going to show you the star formation. By the way, every large red square that you see was published last month. Okay, so but I'm showing you the sum total of all the H2 regions I could find in the outer galaxy. And what you'll notice is most of the H2 regions are new. Oops, that's the H1. Let's go ahead and run the movie. So again, I'm slicing through it in latitude so you can get a sense of what it looks like vertically. Oh, the green stars are masers, by the way. And these are molecular clouds with a more sensitive survey than the Dame et al. Okay, so you see local arm. This is Perseus arm. And then there's some other stuff that you sometimes occasionally see. But here is the relationship between molecular gas and star formation in the outer galaxy. And some of that occurring at distances beyond the break, which lies sort of roughly between here and here. Okay, so here's an example of some star formation sort of right at the break. So now let me show you, in case you didn't see patterns connecting the star formation, let me actually show you the H1 LV diagram in the same way. Local arm, Perseus arm, and then there's another sort of band here called the outer arm. By the way, I noticed when I was making this plot, which I've made for the first time, there's some H2 regions in kinematically not allowed sections of the diagram, which sort of mystifies me. So this is the point here is we now know stars, gas, and star formation very, very well in the outer galaxy. But in case you're wondering why haven't we done all this yet, it's because the star formation came in last month, okay? And actually not all of the H2 regions known in the outer galaxies yet currently have kinematic distances. So I think it's about 50% of them we're able to place in this plot, and 50% we can't. But kinematic distances can be converted to distances, and then we can relate those. So we actually have a way of, we have a whole swath of a galaxy at super high resolution. We can see the individual stars forming. And I think this will be a very, very useful area to make predictions for the relationship between H1, CO, and star formation.
So you have the break for the truncation or whatever, but do you, how good is the stellar disk between here and there?
Well, it depends on how good you think the scale lengths are. It can be done better. And that's why I have color selected out these red clumps, just pure. I want to do this experiment and sort of make sure that I get the same exponential dependence and everything.
And there's the surface density, but there's also the volume density.
Right. Yeah, and I'm interested in doing the volume density. We can always project the surface density later.
Right.
Yeah, but it is. You know, I mean, yeah, again, I think having access to all of this vertical information is where the Milky Way is unique. Plus, you can actually see the stars. So you can actually see which stars have popped out of which H2 region, okay? By the way, I'm gonna have to skip ahead because I don't want to go over. By the way, I did want to say, you can actually see spirals of structure and star formation now across to the far side of the galaxy. So this is actually at L50, so you're looking basically over to the far side of the disk, and you show 10, 12, 14, 16 kiloparsecs collect eccentric radius. This thing is called the outer arm, first discovered in 1957. And you see it's got a lot of star formation in it. By the way, that was not known until a couple of years ago, that there was actually a lot of star formation in the so-called outer arm. But then you also see a structure here called the outer Scutum Centaurus arm. And although it's much further out, there are a few star formation regions that have been identified in the last year out at this large distance, 22 kiloparsecs away from us on the far side of the disk. Question? Okay.
Sorry, with this additional star formation, we revise estimates for what the global star formation rate of the disk is, or have you just made it work with science?
We should be able to revisit the question of the global. I mean, for those of you who, every time I see the Milky Way put on a plot compared to other galaxies, I'm always like, how did they do that? I mean, what is the Milky Way star formation rate, right? Mostly what people do is they take the solar neighborhood star formation rate and extrapolate to the whole galaxy. So we can do better than that.
Usually it's things like radio free free. Right, I mean, you go out and you find like the free catalog, and that misses the outer galaxy because the free catalogs don't go there. But then the question is, you know, I mean, does that, you know, but by excluding everything outside the solar circle, are you making an error that's bigger than 10% by total contribution?
No, but actually, see, the problem with the radio free and all the other surveys except for H1 is that you don't really see much beyond 9 kiloparsecs from the sun.
So you can
perform the thought experiment, like I said at the beginning. Imagine slicing the galaxy in half and throwing away the far half of the galaxy. What if something was entirely going on different on that other half of the galaxy? It would not change our current estimates of the Milky Way star formation, because those were not included.
If there's a lot of star formation, like, it, you know, on the far side of the Milky Way, then there's a big error. But is there any reason to believe that's the case?
Well, I don't know. Are you willing to accept on faith that the Milky Way is symmetric?
Once one point on a diagram containing 30 other galaxies, sure.
Yeah, no, I know. I know. But I do have to say that I'm always mystified about this point when people sort of, I mean, there's also a question. There's also the question about the IMF, right? I'm sorry?
Huh?
As long as it's m greater than or equal to 2, you're sort of okay.
Yeah. No, I mean, I doubt the numbers are going to be coming in any massively different than what we have right now. But it is important to remember that what we've done is we've sampled locally and then extrapolated. Right? And And so that's sort of one of the messages that I think is important. By the way, these CO breaks are starting to be seen in another galaxy. Munoz Mateos, working with Kardec Chef, has actually shown where the stellar breaks happen in some of these other spirals. You actually see there's a CO break as well. So you can actually, this seems to be a generic sort of issue, that the CO break and the stellar break tend to coincide. I mean, or at least there's hints of that. So you know what, I don't want to go tax people's attention. I just wanted to say one other issue. So that was really the one of the first things I wanted to bring to everyone's attention, is that the Milky Way provides a great case where we just recently have now collected the data for stars, gas, and star formation. Well, the gas that we've known for a long time. Stars, now. Star formation, really, in the future. I mean, just because we found the objects doesn't mean we have done anything else, okay? So I just wanted to emphasize a couple other things. First is, in terms of the mapping of the Milky Way, we now have parallaxes for this number of sources. So this is actually the position of the, unfortunately without error bars, sorry about that. But this is the position of the major sources on the artist representation. And so it turns out to kinematically select majors in LV space does mean to select them in XY space, which is very reassuring. It actually means that those patterns in the LV diagram that people have been interpreting and misinterpreting and reinterpreting for years actually probably are patterns in space, okay? And Mark Reed's paper is what you want to read if you want to look at that. He does more things with the galactic structure constants like R naught and theta naught and the mass of the Milky Way. He's more interested in the dynamical concepts. I'm more interested in this in terms of the star formation. But here, this is the other thing I wanted to impress on you. H2 regions in the Milky Way. Number of H2 regions found in radio recombination line surveys as a function of time. So here's Reifenstein, 1970, Wilson, Downs, Caswell, Lachman, Araya, Watson, Cirillo. That's what people have been doing in the past. What Lauren Anderson has done, working with Tom Bainey and some other people, is they've identified all of the 24 micron bright smudges along the galactic plane. The 24 microns is bright because O stars are warming up the dust, and the dust glows in 24 microns, right? I think everyone, that's an extra galactic distance star formation indicator too, right? So I mean, basically, it's the same thing, but you can see these 24 micron smudges. And so what Lauren Anderson did is he took those 24 micron smudges from MIP scale, so just in the intergalactic plane, and then he went to the Green Bank Telescope and did radio recon lines observations of all of them. 95% of the objects he selected were H2 regions and that were previously not known. So basically, this 24 micron bright emission seems to be a 95% successful way of detecting unknown H2 regions, okay? And so this showed where he was in 2010, but most recently, the papers come out last month showing, now they, on the same scale, there's the plot I just showed you, okay? And here are the number of 24 micron objects that he has identified in the WISE survey, okay, the WISE catalog. So we've gone from just under 2,000 up to 8,398 H2 regions in the Milky Way, and that was last month.
How well does the 24 micron luminosity correlate with the inferred ionizing luminosity from the free?
That's a good question, and the I know that's in. I know that the previous work actually shows that plot with the radio recom lines, and actually, I mean, they're using radio continuum, but I don't know how. I can't tell you, so I can point you to the paper.
Okay.
By the way, there's other surveys that are also finding star formation related objects. There's the red MSX survey. These are 8 micron bright smudges, 4,600 objects. The Milky Way project, which comes out of our data. They found 5,100 bubbles. I mean, all of this stuff has shown up in the past 2 years, okay? And right now we are in the state of just finding it, okay?
So what is the difference, though, between that 8,000 H2 regions and that very small number?
Why is the difference?
I mean, are those fainter? Are they more distant?
No, it's just more complete.
Are they intrinsically fainter, or are they
Well, there's a couple factors. One is that the even the original sample based on NIPSCAL was sort of incomplete. He just picked up what he thought were the brightest things without. So he went back to the NIPSCAL and found more. But the most of this is just coverage, right? This was this little thing here was based on well, this is the. Oh, by the way, I should point out, this was the confirmed number. So, okay, but that was 95%. And that was only, I think, a quarter of their full sample from NIPSCAL. So a lot of this, of course, like this is all mostly unconfirmed, right? But it's all the 24 micron smudges that are cataloged. And the big advance is just using WISE, because it's all sky, you know, covers everything.
So it's not it's because previous surveys were small, but
yeah,
otherwise, it's not that this is going to increase the star formation rate by a factor of, you know, 40 or whatever.
No, I mean, essentially what it was saying was our old sample was a very incomplete sample, mostly biased to the local neighborhood, and so what we're finding now is that there are, I mean, not surprised, right? There's lots of star formation across the galaxy that has not been cataloged until we had a way to identify it. And the only way to identify it was the 24 micron, because you couldn't do recom, you couldn't do the radio recom line surveys. It would take too long. And
well,
you couldn't, pardon?
I was going to say, just with regard to Eve's point, I mean, by number, you know, remember it's dndm goes as n to the minus 2, right? So by number, they're all the little ones, but,
right.
You know, they contribute
exactly.
Only logarithmically to the total budget.
Or the distant ones.
So that's why I was wondering about the, you know, whether it was area or, what's it, luminosity or
whatever. Right, but even if it's area, it's,
Yeah, I mean, it's both. I mean, basically, a B-star H2 region in the WISE data can be detected at a distance of 50 kiloparsecs. And so,
will this give us a better handle on the exact luminosity function? Because,
absolutely.
DNDM is 2 minus 2.
Yes, plus or minus. Yes.
But
I agree.
That fractional part is pretty important.
Knowing that luminosity function better would be nice.
Knowing that luminosity function would be nice. And of course, the big challenge here is the distance. Right? We need to get the distances to all of these. And so, of the sample of 8,000. They have distances, basically H2 recom line velocities, and converted in distance for 1,500. And then they've estimated the distances for another 1,500 based on associating with molecular gas. So that's 3,000 out of the sample of 8,000, where they can at least give you a first stab of the distance. But that leaves 5,000 to be decided in terms of how do you figure out its distance to convert. You know, the brightness function into a luminosity function. But one of the interesting things is, of course, is you do find these things in bands in the LV diagram. So you're really sorry that these things are localized to arms and sometimes inner arm regions. So, but it's all very new. And so this survey partially overlaps with this. There's about a 40% overlap of 35 or 40% of these lie in these. This also includes YSOs, and then we have the infrared bubbles, which I'm trying to make a Venn diagram of the overlap of these samples, because these are different ways to pull out different things. And so it's still, I do think I've already seen the evidence that this catalog is incomplete. Okay, but no, incomplete at the 10% level or 20% level, I don't know. So that's, you know, I've gone over way too long. So let's actually stop there. Most people want to hear about other arms, which I know. Yes, no. I don't know how rigorous we are to time on this group.
A
little bit? Okay. Well, let me just point out one other arm, okay? There's this thing called the scutum arm, and that was the major structure sort of near the bar. And how many of you are aware of Alyssa Goodman's work on this? There's an infrared dark cloud that stretches along 10 degrees along the plane. Anyone aware of this?
Is this Nessie?
Nessie was Jim Jackson's thing, and Alyssa has created Nessie Extended. Okay, so it turns out that Nessie arguably goes from here all the way over to here in galactic longitude. And remarkably, when you plot up the velocities of Nessie on an LV diagram, it actually matches with the scutum arm, what used people have also referred to as the molecular ring. So it does appear there's a very, very dense cloud. And of course, we all have known, if you knew, if you believe a lot of star formation happens in the molecular ring, well, just call it an arm, it's the same structure. So there's basically, you know, here's a piece of it. It doesn't come out very well. But the one thing I wanted to say about this arm is, here's the, in the artist picture, here's it represented. And so Nessie is this section, or extended Nessie is this section of it. Okay, doesn't look very impressive on the scale, does it? I mean, they're just seeing a dark cloud that goes from here to here. But you might have noticed that dark cloud was actually below the midplane. And the reason it's below the midplane is because the sun is actually above the midplane. So we actually look down at it a little bit. And so it turns out its position below the midplane is actually consistent with the position of the sun above the midplane. And one of the reasons Alyssa, I think, really got excited about this is because it turns out that you can actually use the latitude of an object as a distance proxy if you believe the object is in the midplane. Okay, which, why would you believe that? There's been some fights on the group about that issue. But anyway, I think the interesting thing about that particular arm, is the major structure of star formation, is that we're seeing these incredible infrared dark clouds, also at very high pressures along the midplane. There's a study that I didn't look up, I mentioned it even, I've forgotten to look it up. But there's a study that actually argues that the pressures of the molecular clouds in this structure are different than other places in the galaxy. So it's a sort of interesting area. But what I wanted to mention about this is its effect on the galaxy. I think there's another effect of this star formation and the scutum arm going on in the Milky Way. And this part I want you to realize, whereas I think the break, everyone agrees on the break in the Milky Way who's ever tried to do it. This is more my own speculation. But it turns out that if you take this arm, okay, it turns out that in this arm, there are a few super bubbles and Schuprecht shells that I've identified. And this is this is the major area of star formation in the Milky Way, right? The molecular ring slash arm. So what is the effect? Well, the effect, I think, is the following. You have lots of star formation. You have lots of explosions. You have some major supershells in this arm, and I've actually drawn them to scale in the artist picture. So if you have all that star formation, maybe you get winds and outflows. And so what I'm showing you in this picture is, this is the ROSAT. The grayscale here is the ROSAT X-ray emission map of the inner part of the Milky Way. Okay. By the way, some of you may not. The reason I ended up in Wisconsin is I came to Wisconsin to work with Don Cox on this, okay, and I failed because this X-ray emission was called galactic bulge emission, and so we were trying to put X-ray emitting gas in the center of the galaxy and we're trying to blow it out, and we could not get the gas to go out of the center of the galaxy because the potential was so deep, and the only way we could get gas to go out of the center of the galaxy was to heat it up to such a high temperature that it violated these X-ray constraints. So I was like, gosh darn it, and I failed on. But it turned out that I got smarter and realized that Don had given me the wrong project, okay? Because if you look at this X-ray emission, do people sort of notice that it goes from here all the way to here on the plot? But do you believe me there? It's not symmetric in longitude. It goes from a longitude of plus 30 to a longitude of minus 50. What else goes from a longitude of plus 30 to minus 50? The scutum arm. So I basically, you know, been working on, and we developed models for this flow. We didn't talk about its geometry. But there's actually, you can put together a pretty good case that there's not just all the star formation in the arm, but there's actually hot gas flowing up out of the arm and down below the arm, okay? And its longitude matches right. We already have wind models that actually explain the vertical distribution of the X-ray emission. And so that's gotta have an interesting effect on star formation. Now we don't know if it's a wind or a fountain, but there's certainly a lot of gas being energized in this region of the galaxy. And That would be true even if you don't buy this idea.
So the X-rays are okay as long as it's closer than the galactic center?
Yeah, because the potential's lower. I mean, that was the thing.
Not just the potential, but also the brightness.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there were all sorts of, I mean, that was after I finished my postdoc with Don and it felt like such an utter failure, I actually realized, you know what, we could solve this issue by pulling it out to another place where we know we have a lot of energy, which is the molecular ring. And so we moved it out, and John Everett did his wind models with the cosmic ray thermal-driven winds out at that large radius, and that made all the difference, basically. So we're now actually starting to look at the kinematics of this, like what happens to the velocity field of this. But I mean, if people are interested in that, I'd love to get your thoughts and feedback on that, because I really do think this X-ray emission. Now, one of the confusions is some of this X-ray emission has been interpreted as local features, like radio loop 1, North Polar Spur. Other parts of this X-ray emission have been identified as more distant features, like Fermi bubble. With X-ray alone, you have no velocity discrimination, so you don't know what's foreground, background. But it's a mix of different things. But I think this is in the mix. So we'll stop there. That was the only thing I wanted to add. So thanks very much for your attention. And I'm here all the way through Thursday. Well, any questions? You asked about hot gas, so I had to throw this in. I don't see evidence of hot gas flowing out of Perseus arm. I don't see evidence of hot gas flowing out, in large amount. But this area, maybe. And it would make sense. If you actually look at face down on other spirals, the X-ray diffuse emission corresponds to the spiral arms. Any questions? Yeah.
So in within this arm where you might correlate the outflows to, how big is the star formation rate surface density?
I knew you'd ask that, or I knew someone would ask that. I don't know. Like I said, the proxies for star formation rate in the Milky Way are so new. And many of the H2 regions, for instance, in this arm have been discovered just recently. Many of our bubbles, our Milky Way project bubbles, are in that arm.
It was necessary to assume.
Yeah, what we did in our models is we said we ended up using about 100% of the energy, supernova energy, for the galaxy, actually. But that was assuming this was a complete circle, right? You can cut that down a lot by actually limiting the actual coverage of this on the disk. The paper actually, I can give you the details on it, but it turns out it uses most of the available supernova power. It produces a mass outflow, the models do, of 2 to 4 solar masses per year.
That would be high.
If it covered the full disk, yeah, a complete circular ring. The models that John Everett did were really nice to, because they also explained something a little mysterious about the Milky Way, which is that, the tracers of star formation peak at sort of 3 to 5 kiloparsec, but the gamma ray emission doesn't show that. So the thing is, if you create open field lines in the inner part of the Milky Way, then you can advect out the cosmic rays and which is consistent with his model, right? So it might help to solve the discrepancy between gamma ray measures of star formation with other things. So it had a lot of advantages. I should mention that we've been trying to put rotation in the models, all of our fits are going wonky. And it's very hard, actually, to put rotation in and still even just match the diffuse X-ray emission. So we've been struggling with that. These models were 1D models, not a sin in rotation. And rotation really does mess with the models. Well, essentially, you're launching your wind from a rotating platform. And so you're already at part of the way to the escape speed, right? And so what one of the effects is, it actually turns out harder to find a wind solution. I mean, we were always sort of saying we want to create a sonic point. We want to create a sonic point right about here, because that's where the extra ray emissivity starts to die. Um, but But we're finding it harder and harder to actually get a wind solution out of this once we conclude rotation. And the details of it I can't really address right now. But what one of the issues is, we can get fountain solutions. We can get x-rays that would then just fall back. We just can't get it through the sonic point to go to escape velocity. So maybe it's just maybe that just says we're overly concerned about matching it as a wind, right? We should just allow it to be a wind or a fountain, whichever. But that's, you know, but John Everett's code is optimized to find wind solutions, and so we'd like to give it our best shot. Yeah.
I wonder how is it possible to report spiral in case can extend across the disk graph?
It's a good question, but it does. Actually, even now we're talking about it and we're saying, well, you know, it could be a wave propagation, right? I mean, that you're driving a spiral arm, but the gas disturbance can continue even when the stellar density goes down.
So there is no probably very weak spiral arm in stars in the outer crust.
Yeah, or non-existent. Yeah.
Kind of entrained spiral gas.
So I mean, I think almost certainly beyond the disk break, we're talking about gaseous spiral arms without any stellar overdensity. Since there are no stars, yeah. since we're now matching onto an outer scale length of about a kiloparsec and a half, probably. So the spiral structure goes out much further. So, interesting, tough problem actually. Yeah.
How long is that extended snake structure?
I think it's about 200 parsecs or so in length. So, and people are finding more and more of these. There's always fights over how to name things, but it's giant molecular filaments or massive molecular filaments, but large-scale coherent molecular bands and LV diagrams.
Does it exactly follow the spiral arm?
Yeah, as it turns out, NESSI does, or extended NESSI. I mean, Tom Dame was floored because Tom Dame actually overplotted the velocity of NESSI extended on the LV diagram where he had already created a track for the scutum arm, and it lay on it. It was as if you had fit it. But which convinced him. But there are other molecular filaments that do not look like that, and you might be interested. I mean, there are other bands that are much higher pitched, and so maybe those are spurs, feathers, interarm features. I mean, you've been talking to someone who knows a lot more about that than I do, probably. So, at least in terms of the data. So anyway, so there's the Milky Way, at least what I know. So. But I think it's a good galaxy to know. So.